podcast where memoir and Ireland share the stage. We talk with authors, guides, ghostwriters, and other free spirits drawn to memoir or enchanted by Ireland. I'm Barb Robitaille.
And I'm Craig Stewart.
Conversation recorded with Kate Carrigan, New York Times best-selling author. A second-generation Irish woman, Kate is best known for her Ellis Island trilogy, a historical novel set in the 1920s, which chronicles the life of emigrant Ellie Hogan and the difficult choices she must face as she juggles her sense of self and responsibility between her new home in America and family in Ireland.
Born and raised in London, Kate returned to her beloved Irish family roots in the 90s, eventually settling in Killala to be near her mother and their family home in Ballina, a short distance away. Kate prides herself on being a writing evangelist. In addition to her vast body of work, she teaches students at the National University Ireland, Galway, about the finer points of crafting narrative. Find out more about Kate by heading to her website, katecarrigan.org, where she's offering a free download of Dublin Kiss when you subscribe to her newsletter.
We are thrilled that she will be joining us on the memoir tour for an evening of reading, sharing writers' tools of the trade, and for some good Irish crack.
Ah, that'll be grand, yeah. You know, I think people will be surprised how Kate began her writing career. It's pretty impressive. It just goes to show.
Doesn't it, though? And I love how she says that writing is an act of great audaciousness.
Yeah, me too. Yep.
And another thing that I remembered in the conversation, the older we are, the closer to the truth we become.
Boy, isn't that the truth? I mean...
But it does touch something, right?
Well, I think it does. Yeah.
I think there's a way in which being drawn to memoir at this time in my life, even though I've read memoir, you know, at a younger age, but right now it just feels all the more poignant in my own self as I contemplate putting pen to paper and writing stories from my life.
Right, right. And she talks about that a bit, about how you have to sort of sift through all of the narrative and all of the information that you have.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to sift through.
There is. If I can just remember what it was.
Yeah, right. And so I think that's part of the journey, part of the process that's interesting, and part of the reflection and the sweetness, sometimes bittersweetness, of thinking back over our lives.
Yeah. You know, she said something else that I think, when she said it, I thought of you. And that was that sometimes giving yourself permission not to write.
Boy, yeah, isn't that true? I loved it when she said that, because I'm one that gets so knotted up, even thinking about where to begin, or it's not going to be good enough. I'll talk myself out of it, and I'll dance around the pen and paper forever. And so when she said that today, it was like, oh, I felt, you know, I felt myself soften and think, okay, I don't have to do this. And you know what? It's almost like I can't wait to start. Just that little bit of breathing room, thinking like, this is not the biggest deal here, you know, in the whole world here, Barb.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
I do have to point out that we made the recording through the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty amazing to think about that it's going all the way from Little Mill Creek, Washington, all the way over to Ireland. Just, you need to listen with attentive ears. The recording may sound like she's talking far away. And guess what?
She was.
Yeah. She was.
It's the truth,
that's
right?
That's the truth, yeah.
Didn't have to sift too far to find that one.
Yeah. Okay. So there you have it.
Enjoy.
I'm speaking today with Kate Carrigan, New York Times best-selling author of the Ellis Island trilogy. Kate is across the sea. She's in Killala, County Mayo, Ireland, which is perhaps my favorite place on the planet.
And Kate, it's lovely to have you today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Craig. It's great to talk with you.
You are a prolific writer. You've got so much to your credit. And I'm curious, when did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Well, I didn't really. I was very, very bad in school. I left school when I was very young. I was about 15. And I came from a family of readers and writers. And because I did so badly in school, couldn't get on with any kind of conventional education whatsoever. I really felt that it was beyond me, and became a hairdresser. From the age of 15 to 19, I was a hairdresser. I had a kind of a creative soul. I think I was about 20, I started writing. I started I had this flatmate, and she said, you know, you're really funny, you should write some of your stories down. And I'd always written poetry and stuff like that, but for me, writing was something that was very connected with education and school. So it was something that I certainly never thought that I could get into as a job. I just started writing these funny stories to amuse myself.
Mm-hmm.
Showed them to a few friends, and they said, you know, these are really funny, you should get them published. And as a young hairdresser, one of my clients, her husband worked on a teenage girls magazine that was, it was Top of the Pops at the time. This was in the 80s. It was a really big deal. It was called Just 17. And I got in front of her husband. I was 19 or 20 years old. And he read my stuff. And he said, you know, this is great. I love it. It was an article about bringing my boyfriend home to meet my mother. And it was called Mum Meets Frankenstein. And it was the first thing I ever wrote, and he published it right off the bat. And he just encouraged me and said, you know, you can really do this, and that was it. So I've been earning my living just from writing and editing, with a little bit of hairdressing in between.
Keep your hand in it.
For free. fringe trimming and a few highlights for free on friends and family.
Uh-huh.
But I've been doing that really since I was 20, earning my living doing that. And I'm now 54. So that's quite, I find myself in quite an unusual position, you know?
Yeah.
To have been able to be very lucky, yeah.
Absolutely. I said, you're an author, teacher, mother, daughter, wife, sister. How do you keep it all going?
Because I'm mainly a writer.
You've had these wonderfully successful books. And by the way, I'm right in the middle of The Perfect Marriage. And there's a quote in there that I absolutely love. And I wanted to ask you where that came from that you wrote. If you could just hang on a second. If you don't mind me reading
this. Yeah, no, go ahead.
I love this quote. Although I wasn't born there, I spent much of my childhood and student years there. For me, Ireland is the brooding brown boglands lit up by a thousand shades of purple and gold by a temperamental sun. It is the sour smell of burning turf on a wet day and my grandmother's rhubarb tart. It is Joyce, Yeats, Behan, Patrick Kavanagh, a complex creative heritage too vast to attempt explanation. I love that. Now,
goodness me, did I even write that? I've no recollection of writing that whatsoever, but I must have. I guess I must have done.
I think you must have.
When I stand up for it, it's true.
Yeah. So is this Tressa speaking, or is this Kate Kerrigan speaking?
Well, it's very much me speaking. I think the. You know, I think the view of Ireland from the second generation Irish person, from the person who was brought up elsewhere, does have a very romantic tint to it. And I certainly experienced that. You know, I grew up in London and then came home every summer holiday to my grandparents, house in Ballina, County Mayo. And that connection has been very important for me in my writing. But more than that, personally, really, that's been my journey, that really brought me into my early 50s, the journey of identity and identifying myself as Irish, even though I grew up in London and have an English accent. And it's an interesting one. For those of us, I mean, there are the second, third, fourth generation Irish Americans whose grandparents or parents came to America. And, you know, to be an Irish American is very much, you know, a thing. It's a very kind of strong identity. But that identity is much more complex and difficult in many ways when you are second generation and you have grown up in the UK, you know, because of the history that exists between the two countries. So we don't actually even have, we can't call ourselves Anglo-Irish because that's a different thing entirely. We are very almost like parochial. We're London Irish, Manchester Irish, Liverpool Irish. You know, we don't have a title. We don't have a kind of over, you know, we have a very mixed identity that's quite fraught. So writing about Ireland, and even though I don't write about that specifically, or I've never written about that specifically yet, in a novel, certainly the island, particularly my mother's generation and my grandmother's generation, holds a kind of a mystery for me, but also an infatuation. You know, I'm kind of infatuated with it.
Oh, of course you must be. Yeah. Yeah. How long have you lived in Killala?
I've lived back in Ireland since 1990.
Okay.
So I moved here in my mid-20s, but I still feel, it's very strange, I still feel on the one hand like I've just arrived, and then on the other hand as if I am truly Irish. Like when I go over to London, which I do quite frequently, you know, I would go into shops and I would nearly expect people to say, "Are you over on holiday?" I think I speak with an Irish accent, even though I markedly don't.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's an odd one. But I've lived here for a long time. And of course, my mother is in Ballina, which is down the road from Killala, which is how I came to be in Killala, because we still have our family home there. It's the home where I came on holidays. It's the home where my mother grew up. No one has ever lived in the house except for my mother. And it's full of old photographs. There's a little chalet in the back garden where I write, which is full of, you know, childhood artifacts.
That brings me to a good question, or a question I have for you. How do you find the motivation or drive to park yourself in front of the keyboard every day to write 100,000 words a stretch?
It's really, really hard. And it gets hard as I get older. I think that that sounds very dramatic. I suppose it's not. What's hard about it is I have found that I have to constantly change motivation. The motivation to write for me is a movable, ongoing feast. So I might, you know, sometimes I need to be in a place where I'm surrounded by other people and yet with no distractions. So sometimes I will write a book in my accountant's office. They give me a corner of their grey offices, and I go in there and I sit in a little desk in the corner and write. And then other times I want to be in the shed in my mother's back garden looking out at the laburnum tree and I can't write. And then sometimes I have to be at home. And I find that for a lot of writers who are under this kind of almost like a professional pressure to write, that some of us just do move around a lot, and then others just sit down at the same time in the same place every single day, year on year on year. But I find that it moves around a lot. And I think just accepting that it isn't easy.
Right.
I mean, on Friday, you know, I'm having on Friday, I'm having technical problems at the moment. So just 2 days ago, I lost 1,500 words. Mm. And they were really, really, really hard words that had taken me ages to get to. And so I basically just found that quite difficult. Sometimes I find things like that quite difficult to get over.
Yeah.
Where I kind of think, well, they must be somewhere. And then I can lose like 3 days looking for these lost words. And this morning I just sat down, I just had to give myself a talking to and say, look, they're gone, you know? So you just have to sit down and get back and get back into it again. You know, I think accepting that sometimes it's going to be easier than other times. You know, some books are easier to write than others. And that there is always going to be some struggle involved if it's going to be good.
I like that. I like that a lot. Because a lot of people coming on the tour will be first-time writers or have been struggling with writing. And I think it's good to hear that from you.
Yeah, I think it. I mean, the thing is, like, then it becomes like, you know, I think the thing that, one of the things that I talk about a lot, actually, when I'm teaching is the writer's ego. You know, and whether you're starting out or whether you've been doing it a long time, you know, writing, just even as a thing to do, making the decision to write, is an act of great audaciousness, you know, of egotistical audaciousness. You know, the idea that we have something in our head that we're going to put down on paper, that's important enough to put down on paper, that other people might read or other people might not read. You know, whether you want to get it published or not published, the idea of making a record of your thoughts is in itself quite an egocentric act.
Yes.
You know?
And yes.
That can cause, that can cause a lot of blockages. That can cause a lot of problems. It's the reason why we write, and yet it is the thing that most often undoes us as writers. You know, if it was me saying, oh my goodness me, I have lost these words that are so important. This is like, you know, this is just like, and then when I stop and say to myself, you know what? It's not important. You know, if you don't write anything ever again, nothing is going to happen. The earth is not going to stop moving. Yeah? Your readers will all survive. Yes, yeah. You've got people saying, oh, when's your next book coming out, blah, blah, blah. You know, but, like, they're just being nice. No one's world is going to stop or grind to a halt if there isn't another Kate Carrick book. So, you know what, you could just, like, stop doing this, and it wouldn't make any difference. And it's really important for me to hold that space sometimes and to get into that space, because then that gives me permission to not write. And sometimes having permission to not write becomes as important as having the permission to write, because it liberates you.
Oh, well said. Thank you, for saying that.
It can become a bind, and there's no one binding us except ourselves. There's no one saying you must write this except for ourselves, whoever we are.
Yeah. Well, I can see why you call yourself a writing evangelist. that sums it up right there, which also suggests there's a need to bring others into the fold. And do you see writing as something that needs to be promoted for the general public, non-authors?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that there's something quite interesting happening in society at the moment that people are kind of missing, which is that we are all writing. You know, everyone now is writing because we are all texting. And the world has become a place where, I mean, when I started writing on, not on an electric typewriter, on an ordinary typewriter.
Oh, no.
And then I got an electric typewriter when I was in my late teens. I remember when I started writing. So that was a long time ago. And back in those days, writing was something that was done. It was a job. It was done by certain people who were able to write. And we were just this little exclusive group of people. And everyone else just had a blank page. And they talked to each other. And they talked on the phone. And they did that kind of stuff. magazines and media that I worked in for a long time. It was a particular thing, you know, it was a particular job. And now everyone in the whole world, every time you send a text to somebody, or particularly every time you put something on social media, you are publishing something. Every time you send someone a text, which has become a ubiquitous way now of communicating, you are writing. And I think this is something that people miss sometimes. You know, you might not be writing in a thoughtful way or in a meaningful way, but writing has become the preferred method of communication in the world. You know,
yeah.
Like it used to, and I understand that because I prefer writing as a form of communication to speaking or being. The remove of writing is my preferred way of communicating with the world. Like I would prefer, I have a newspaper column, and my husband sometimes reads about what's happening in our marriage in the newspaper column. And in fact, he doesn't read the newspaper column in case he reads anything like that. So his friends in the pub read the newspaper column. We'll go into the village. And Martin, you know, the post will come up and say, oh, she's not happy with you this week. And he'd be like, is she not? And he'd say, oh, no. And then he'd tell him why. So I'm going to set this world up for myself where I get to do that.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
And so even though it might not be the most functional way, you know, of operating our relationships or even operating within society, it is a new reality. And I think it's one that we can tap into. Do you know? Like I would use a lot of oral technology now. I would and encourage people to do, you know, particularly people writing memoir or people who have blockages or people who, you know, a lot of older people I find, a lot of very older, very educated people who are coming into writing, like say, for instance, you know, retired school teachers. Who would have a very literary sensibility, and they often find it quite difficult to put their thoughts down on paper because there's this big block between what they want to say and how they want to say it, you know?
Yes.
And what they think is good writing, what they think is bad writing. You know, to those people, I would say, just pick up your phone and just talk into the phone, you know, and write in that way. Just don't even write, just talk, just dictate everything and then put it down. And then you'll see what you have. You see the essence of what you have. And then you can work it. You know?
Right.
Because often the point gets lost behind the language. And that's one of the exciting things for me about technology is it can enable us older writers sometimes to access that kind of freedom that a lot of the younger writers have, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, good point. That raises a question for me. There's the fact that there is so much writing. It seems like one of the jobs of a writing evangelist would be to create a discerning eye for what is true or what is so-called good writing and what's bad writing. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that the only way that you can assess that is if you're a reader. You know, and if you, I mean, that to me is one of the gaps with a lot of younger students that I teach is that perhaps they're not reading enough, you know, or they're not reading widely enough, or they're not reading. There is so much good young adult literature around, and there are so many fascinating and wonderful ways now to absorb narrative. So on the one hand, I feel that a lot of the young writers have a very strong sense of narrative, And in many ways better storytelling abilities than their older peers, but perhaps and that they say things in a much more straightforward way a lot of the time. But perhaps what they are missing is nuance. Do you know? That comes from reading widely and reading, you know, a wide and appreciating, you know, a broad mix of writing. But my personal opinion with writing is that the quicker and more concisely you can say something, the better.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and really, the you know, as a teacher, I suppose, and you know, the thing that would drive most of us the maddest going through stuff is overuse of language.
Right.
That's the big pit.
Right. Right.
For
no,
most
I.
People,
yeah.
It's just using too much language.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. Let's go back a little bit to. We have some retired teachers coming on the tour. And,
oh, great.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And they've spent, a couple have spent some time writing memoir, and a couple have not. With memoir, what do you find is compelling or moving, or what makes for good memoir?
Well, it's the human experience. You know, it's the human experience and the truth. And that is all people want. That is what is interesting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it is the story, you know, it is the story behind the story. And that's what every writer of memoir needs to be reaching for, is the truth. And I think that the older that we are, the closer to the truth we become. But yet sometimes it's harder to find, because there is so much history and there is so much narrative behind it. Do you know?
I do, yeah.
So it's really, it's going through and, you know, it requires, I think, a courage and a connection to yourself is the most, you know, is for me what it is, and to take yourself on that very kind of personal journey. We have this thing called I Tell a Lie. It was on a Tuesday. And what that is that, you know, you're uptown and you're talking to someone and they've got some fantastic piece of gossip for you, you know? someone's having an affair with somebody and they just want to, and you're just like, tell me exactly what happened. You know, you just want to know the story. And they come and they say, oh, yeah. I saw the woman and she was coming down, she was wearing a red coat and I was so lovely. Now it was Monday. No, it wasn't Monday. Was it Monday afternoon or was it when I tell a lie, it was on a Tuesday. And while that, it doesn't matter what day it was on, we don't care.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
What day it was on, we don't care about all the semantics and the logistics. What we want is the truth behind, the truth underneath, the human story. That's what we want. And that's what we want from memoir.
Ah, that's very helpful. Very helpful indeed. And we will definitely put this out to our people.
Great. Oh, I look forward to meeting. I really look forward to it now. I look forward to meeting them.
Yeah, we're going to have a good time. It's a great group of people coming, and they're excited. They're excited to write, and they're excited to be in Ireland, and especially County Mayo. My goodness, what a beautiful place you live in.
Yeah, it is. It's great. And it really is steeped. It's just steeped in so much history.
Yeah.
And so much narrative, you know?
Yeah, oh, it's, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Kate, thank you for your time. I've so enjoyed reading your books, and...
Oh, thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you and Barbara when you come over. It'll be great. So give us, you know, we'll have plenty of notice and everything. And
well, we'll head up to the Village Inn to read about what you're doing. And then we'll get in touch with you. All right. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Good talking. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Ink and Pete, a production of Memoir Tours Ireland. You can learn more about Memoir Tours and find other podcasts on our website, memoirtours.com.
And we'd love to know if you have ideas for shows or requests. We'd love to hear from you. Contact Craig or Barb at memoirtours.com.
Until next time, may you find joy where you least expect it.